Hey, it's Kristen. You're listening to Rational in Portland.
Welcome to Rational in Portland. I'm your host, Kristen. Today, Andy Chandler from the podcast Northwest Fresh is co-hosting. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks. Always happy to be here.
I got you all set up. I've got your bar stool because I know you prefer that.
You don't have to tell people.
I always have
that.
It. I always have it every time. I love it. I absolutely love it. And Dan Ryan is our guest today. Dan Ryan is on Portland City Council, and he is the one city councilor from our last council's session from our previous form of government who is still on city council. Dan, welcome, District 2.
Thank you. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Thank you for
with both of you.
Yeah, some of it here.
Double dose.
I'm just here to get Dan's breakdown from the NFL draft. No, I'm just kidding.
That was
what happened with Sanders, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
We just lost so many people.
We can talk about it later if you want.
Yeah. No, you didn't. I'm sure you didn't. I'm certain that the only person you probably lost was me because I'm such a moron about
just
sports.
Know this: the Ducks had more people go to the NFL in the first five rounds than ever before in history. Program.
And you'd think as a duck, I would know that. That's amazing.
Did you even know the draft was going on?
Of course I didn't.
Okay.
What do you think?
It's all good.
You know what I know. We talk. So, Andy, I know we just need to get this out here. You had city council rankings.
I did, yeah.
Dan's probably wondering why he landed on number two. That list.
Yeah, I mean, you could say it was maybe a tie between one and two.
Eric Zimmerman was your number one.
And I'll also say I'm doing a six-month re-ranking with me and Max.
So maybe
he'll be number one, you know, who knows?
What would it take to get him to number one?
I'm not going to reveal that right now.
So Dan, the budget is going to come out. The mayor's budget is going to come out. And then that will be, how is it going to work in this new council though? Is that a template that everybody's expected to work from?
You just asked me how it's going to work in this new council.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, right? Is that the answer?
No, you never know, but I hope it goes something like this. The mayor will come out with his budget on May 5th and we will take some time to look at it and we will, make decisions on where we want to support it and where we want to push back on it. That's kind of our job. He's the executive. He oversees the entire enterprise. That's the new form of government. So our job as legislators is to respond to his budget. Hopefully, if I love it, I'll do everything I can to defend it. If there's some parts of it that I want to improve, I'll do everything I can to try to improve it. That's the game we're in.
What are your priorities?
My priorities have been really consistent from day one. They're the same ones I campaigned on, and they're probably just becoming more clear to me how important they are. And it starts with keeping Portlanders safe. That's got to be the number one responsibility of any city that has police and fire, is to make sure your city is safe, that when you pick up the phone to call 911, not a number you like to call, someone picks up the phone quickly and someone responds very rapidly to your urgent need. That's got to be number one. And we have a long ways to go still. And response times have improved. We finally experienced some good response times during election week because we were finally adequately staffed during that week to prepare for the, you know, to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And luckily it wasn't bad that week. But what people noticed that week is that when they called 911, wow, it got answered right away and the police would show up. And more importantly, they'd stay with you when you actually needed to have a dialogue with them about how maybe you could improve your security at your business. I mean, how many more Portlanders do I have to hear from that say they are one more broken window away from going bankrupt?
They don't have insurance.
They've all lost their insurance because it's just unattainable.
Happened too many times.
Yeah.
It's like a, you know, hurricanes in the Gulf Coast or something.
Yeah, we're an insurance risk for many because just let's face it, how many boarded up windows did we need to see from 2020 beyond? It was untenable after a while.
And we still have them all over the place.
Exactly, because they can't afford to replace them. Now it's more they can't afford to replace them. They don't have insurance to replace them. And for a while, it was just there wasn't enough glass to replace them because there was such a need. Now it's more in the other category of financial challenge. But I'm just tired of hearing so many storefronts that tell me that they haven't made money in years. And it's like we have to really focus on our small businesses, especially in our storefronts. And I've been spending a lot of time because when you're a district rep, you have more time to spend in your neighborhoods and your main streets. So whether it's St. John's or Northeast Broadway or Mississippi. And every storefront owner that you get off the record and just have dialogue with, they're really in a lot of pain and they've been suffering for a while. And it's been going on before COVID, probably a couple of years when the humanitarian crisis really was spilling into our streets, the need for people on our streets to have another, you know, trying to buy drugs and doing them openly just really went up. And as we know, when a drug addict needs to get their fix, they're going to do whatever it takes to get the money. And breaking a window and robbing a business is one of the safer ways to do that.
What is the answer to the argument coming from counselors like Angelita Murillo and Samir Kanal about how police, we're spending more on police than ever. Police have more money than they did last year. Or police, you know, the budget's just increasing. And if we don't feel safer, there's no reason to continue to increase it. Those kind of arguments.
I just don't think they're talking to too many people that are actually trying to survive and thrive running a business in Portland. They haven't talked to the elder who still doesn't feel safe today to go on a walk in Old Town. There's people that literally still feel trapped in their homes because they don't feel safe to just walk around on their sidewalks. They don't feel safe to take the MAX train anywhere because it's not safe to them. It's smelly. It's just so they don't even know how to get around. So I don't know if I can't understand how you could say that if you're actually on the porches listening to Portlanders or you're at the storefronts listening to Portlanders. So it's a mystery to me why someone would say that.
But isn't one of the reasons that we're spending more is because of overtime? We're spending money on overtime for officers?
Of course, because when we're in this chronic state, like we have to get out of it. So when you've been chronically understaffed for a while now, the only way to respond to big incidents or when there is an incident, say there is a big crime on Northwest 21st that takes 20 people.
Oh, you mean like a guy in a tent with knives, for instance?
There you go. And those are real stories. And so
it literally happened. It blew me away.
That takes up all of the police in that precinct to respond. And so you have such a limited number coming in the rest of the city. Guess what? Other things go on. And those, when you hear from people that the police just didn't show up, and it's maybe because their crime wasn't, someone wasn't in front of them with a knife or something. But it's this chronic understaffing leads to this perpetual overtime issue, because there's going to be incidents that occur.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, the election week when they had all this extra staffing. And, you know, I just always remind people that it's like there are cities in the country, a lot of them that in the 51 other weeks of the year have appropriate staffing levels. That is possible. We can achieve that as a city if we want to prioritize that. And I'm happy that Dan is prioritizing that. But sometimes I think people forget that there's an escape out of that and there's an exit.
Yeah, that's what we're getting at here. So if you hire more police, overtime will come down.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you're understaffed, then overtime will continue to be a talking point for, quite frankly, people who I think would like to keep defunding police. Mm-hmm. So it's this game where it's like you keep talking about the abuse of overtime when it's like, no, it's because the police are doing the best they can to respond to a critical incident, which bumped up the overtime. Mm-hmm. And you want to keep that cycle going, then continue to not staff our police properly.
Right. Yeah, it could save a lot of money, which is a huge topic of conversation right now.
Simply enough, we just don't have enough officers.
Yeah.
That's it. And I think most Portlanders get that. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that their voices show up during the budget deliberations. We need to hear from you. I understand. I hear it from very close friends that they're intimidated to testify in such rational ways at city council meetings. First of all, you can come with a few friends. It's great. You can also do it through a Zoom call. And those are appropriate ways to testify as well. And our office would love to work with you and make sure that you feel supported, because your voice really matters.
So what do we say to people who are afraid, to come? Because I know you've heard from constituents who want you to do things. And I mean, isn't the answer, I need you to explain to the other city councilors that these are things that we want.
Well, I have empathy for them, and they have a tendency to bring up, well, look what happened to you. Look what happened to Jesse Burke down at Society Hotel. And
right.
So your my spouse, I can't put my family in jeopardy. I can't put my business in jeopardy. Like, I want to testify, but I'm worried about the consequences it would have for my family or my business. And so when you listen to that, you feel a little heartless by then looping back one more time to say, oh, you can do it. And I say, well, I hope that you know that you'll be supported. And I know that if just more people like you show up, we will solve this problem. I think that people need to know you are actually a big, strong voice out there. And a lot of people will be supportive of that. So I guess it's like a lot of these situations, like you want to activate Portland. We know that Portland's safer when the streets are activated, but you got to get people to do it. And I think it's almost the same way with testifying. So I would say go with a group of people and make it fun. Make it fun because you're doing the civic duty because you love the city of Portland so much.
How will they know when to testify? Will there be anything, any publicity beforehand from your office or from where should they go to know, oh, wow, there's a budget session about public safety. And, you know, Dan said I should show up if I'm interested.
I do hope they follow our website, but there is a website, excuse me, from the council clerk, which is at councilclerk@portlandoregon.gov. And that's the way you register. You can always also find out all the meeting schedules and agendas
there. That's the email.
Yeah. Yeah. That's if you just go to the website.
And I'll link to the website, but people are going to say, well, look, I'm at work every day. Are you telling me I need to go to the city website every single day and find out what the agenda is? And I would say, get on an email list. Like, I don't know. I find Future Portland's helpful.
Yeah. There's a lot of them that'll notify you about stuff that's coming up on meetings.
Okay.
I would also say, can't you just show up at any regular meeting and just testify if you're available, right?
On a non-agenda item. Yeah. I actually don't know if you can do that anymore.
I'm not sure, actually.
No, there's always five at the beginning of the
meeting. Are there five?
Okay. Yeah.
So and you can committees show up at any meeting.
Well. Yeah, committee meetings as well. Like you could go to a public safety committee meeting to testify as well. Mm-hmm. But you could also go to councilor.ryan@portlandoregon.gov. And we will make sure that we have you on our email list and we can steward.
So email Dan. You.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what district they're in.
It doesn't matter for this because this is an all-in effort. We really have to do everything we can to stop the misinformation about the police overtime and that we don't need this many police. We all know that we're understaffed compared to any city our size. And if you can compare it to recent trends in crime, I mean, it's just very clear that we're understaffed. So we have to stop the false narrative. And we have to stop the false narrative that the police abuse overtime when they're merely trying to respond to urgencies and they have to do what they can, which means because we're understaffed, there's more overtime. I get the intimidation. It's real. I do understand it. Trust me.
Well, it happened to you. Can you just, for people who didn't hear your last episode, who maybe don't have the background, can you please just give, and you don't need to like, crack your chest open here and put your heart on the table, though you and I are pretty good at that. But can you please, first of all, I want to just lay some context down because all of us in this city enjoy some throat clearing. I just think it's important that they understand. And I know identity isn't important to a lot of people, but I also know this is Portland and it's front and center for most people, even if they think it's not the most important thing. But just so people understand, you're a gay man.
I am.
And you have a first generation immigrant spouse.
Yes.
Gender fluid spouse.
Yes.
And the home that the two of you share was vandalized countless times because you did not vote to defund the police when you came into office as a city councilor.
Correct. In October of 2020, 1 month after I was sworn in.
And you went outside. I mean, I remember the photos on the news. You went outside to meet the people who were destroying your home, you and your spouse's home.
Yeah, I'm quite an optimist in terms of thinking if you have dialogue, everything can be better.
Were you scared at all?
No, I was just kind of numb, to be honest. It was like it was 11 o'clock at night.
You probably hadn't slept in a while either.
I was falling asleep in the sofa, so I got up because they asked me to come out.
Especially and play. After a month after you've been elected, that's very, it's a weird welcome, you know.
Yeah. And it was at a time where no one was going into their office because we were all locked down. So, you know, maybe they thought coming to my house at 11 o'clock was the one way they could get in touch with me. Blah, blah, blah. But what mattered is I went out there. I did my very best to listen to what they had to say.
And what did you hear?
I heard some of the same slogans that you always hear. There wasn't a lot that was really said. It was just more like telling me that I need to defund the police because they're brutalizing everyone. And then I heard some other personal stories, and those were compelling. And I did follow up with folks to see if we could do more dialogue, but no one responded.
You mean personal stories about people who said that they had been brutalized by the police or treated badly?
More about how their life has been difficult because of racial injustice. And of the like 90 some people, I think there were two people of color besides my spouse, there would have been three. And I listened to them the most.
Sure.
Because it was called Black Lives Matter. So I wanted to hear from people who were actually Black.
Yeah.
Which in there, I think there were two out of 90 some.
So I moderated a safety panel recently it was supposed to be with the chief of police. He was not able to do it. It was with Aaron Schmautz, who's the head of the Portland Police Association, the police union.
Yes.
And Nathan Vasquez, the Multnomah County District Attorney. And one of the questions that I got that I wanted to ask, but we just did not have enough time to unpack the insanity of it, in my opinion. And I think it's a good question. I just think it's illustrative of a cultural issue we have, or maybe we don't. It may not be an issue. I don't know. But what do you think about this question? The question was, in a Trump year, when we have a city, the city of Portland that we live in, that is very interested in opposing our president at every turn, how do we stay focused on public safety? And, you know, in a lot of cities, I don't know that would be a question. In most cities in the U.S., I don't think that's a question. But here, let's unpack this a little. Like, how did public safety, is it right coded, for lack of a better term?
I don't.
And how did that happen?
I want to make sure I know what that means.
I don't. Is it a Trump is it a uniquely Trump agenda item, from one lifelong Democrat to another? Do you? In my memory, maybe we're just too old, but public safety was an agenda of Bill Clinton. That was an agenda of President Obama. President Obama funded drug courts because they work. I mean.
So, yeah, the original question, which I think I got to the first one. Well, we're staying there, which is about public safety being my number one priority.
In a Trump year, how do we continue to be focused on public safety if we're concerned about Donald Trump's presidency, and if this city seems interested in opposing him at every turn, which they do seem interested in.
So first of all, I wish we had a different president, but we don't. If it was President Harris right now, I know that public safety would still be my number one priority.
She's a former district attorney.
So let's just start there. Like, it actually has, this is just a way to, I think, divert the attention away from what we need to deal with in Portland. Our River City has problems that have nothing to do with Donald Trump.
Isn't it an interesting question, though? Like, I don't think that would be a question in most cities. Do you?
I hope not, but I'm trying to answer it the best I can.
I've been despising
this human being longer than almost anyone else I know, because I lived in New York in the 80s, and he's been like a disgusting con artist punk his whole life. So why anyone likes him is beyond me. I fault our education critical thinking system that's eroding. But anyway, back to like what we're supposed to focus on. We need to focus on public safety, period, end of story. Because no matter who the president is, we have trouble here. And we have people who are closing their businesses because they're not getting the type of response they need. We have businesses that are spending their little bit of maybe profit margins on public safety themselves with private security. They're spending money on vandalism. That's eating away at what little profit they were making before 2020. And they're done. They can't continue to make ends meet in Portland, Oregon, and do what they really would like, which is to serve their neighborhoods with their businesses and their storefronts. People become an entrepreneur. They become a creator, an innovator, because that's what gets them up in the morning to experience joy. And Portland should attract those kind of people to our city and make them want to live here and thrive here. And increasingly, more and more are choosing to not do that in Portland because it just doesn't pencil out. And so we need a strong public safety system so we can support those who generate revenue for our city.
I think
it's connected to economic development. You've got to start first with public safety improving, or it's going to be difficult for us to improve our economic footprint. And right now that's suffering and has been suffering.
Are Portlanders allergic to economic development?
What is that? Say more.
Well,
I've never heard that phrase, but it's interesting. Yeah.
It's allergy season. Yeah. So like, this is good.
Is economic development something that Portlanders as a whole are interested in?
I think a lot of Portlanders love being independent and being creative and innovative. And there are a lot of entrepreneurs here. And I think those in the private sector still thrive here, would like to thrive here. And I want them, of course, to be attracted to Portland. Do I think that Portland has an outsized minority of constituents who would like to blow up capitalism, period?
Yeah.
And build this new socialism and let Portland be the epicenter of it and the beginning of it. I guess that's what we're dealing with, because otherwise I would understand how we could get on the, it would be easier to get on the same page with all my colleagues on our economic development strategy, on the realities of the doom loop that we're currently ran into through our own self-inflicted wounds. And so we have to get out of that. And so if you're comfortable with the fact that Portland still exists in the United States of America, which has a capitalistic culture, free market culture, and if you'd like Portland to still be a part of that country.
You mean reality on reality? Yeah. Terms?
So if we can move away from the beautiful slogans, I mean, I love a lot of slogans and the images that come from socialism. If someone could show me how it can pencil out and we could still be happy, joyous, and free and prosperous, I'm all in. But I haven't seen any direct action on how to get there.
You're so annoyingly practical.
Well, this is rational, right? Rational Portland. And so I guess it's really, that's the undertow of what we're talking about right now. Maybe the allergic is that we live in a city that has an outsized political industry that's focused on socialism.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, the one example I always try to highlight for people is like, hey, do you want MLB in Portland? Because like, it could happen. We just need to, we got to make a much more business-friendly city. And I think a lot of people love small business, which is great, but we got to be a little more friendly to medium and large businesses, which I know is, you know, antithetical to a handful of city councilors.
Well, how else are we going to fund all these projects?
I like what you said, because I think some of what we were talking about earlier, although I wasn't articulating it very well, I think we're all like walking on eggshells around this topic.
It's so funny.
Once you started with this allergic reaction, but it is, small businesses become medium-sized businesses.
Right. That's
and
the goal,
and then eventually
right?
your ship comes in and someone, you know, buys your company.
Yeah.
And then you can start another one. My friends are entrepreneurs. That's what they do.
You want to be the next Columbia Sportswear. You want to be the next
and
Nike.
And I think this whole, the far left socialism lobby, it's like they're very anti anything big, except big government, I guess. But they're anti big institutions that make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they don't have some good points about the greed part and you know, how much is too much. Count me in on that dialogue. Mm-hmm. But I think we just take it to a place that's not very rational, because Portland's always been an innovative city that has advanced a lot of small businesses to medium to larger. Sure. And then some of them, you know, get bought out.
Yeah.
But we've been known as a great place to incubate good ideas that have been innovative and successful. We have that opportunity in the green economy as well. Mm-hmm. And so I just don't want to give up on my friends who love the creative and innovative side of the private sector. And I want to be a city where they can feel welcomed in. And I don't know how we'll survive as a city unless we attract. That's why we're in this budget mess. Our revenue comes from our the private sector. This just in. Yeah.
What do you think about that poll that said, that came out recently? The headline was, Portlanders don't want to fund the police.
Well, that was a very missed. Well, let's start from the beginning of that poll. Please. So first of all, thank you, Sophie Peel from Lime Week, for staffing me. So I didn't know about it until I saw the article, like knew nothing about it. So it's like, council? Well, I'm on the council. What is this? So then I found out that two council members took this on and spent $45,000 of taxpayer money to help them think. And so I was baffled by the whole thing. Because leaders don't do that.
Who did this?
It was two well-intentioned fellow counselors. I will say I've talked to both of them, so I feel okay talking about this. I would never do that without talking to them first. It was Counselor Novick and Council President Pirtle Guinea.
So what was the motivation?
The motivation was, I think they wanted to identify themselves as the swingers, the swing votes on council. I guess there's six in one side, four in another. I'm on the lower side, and they feel the responsibility to land this plane called a balanced budget, I guess. I'm trying to put some words in their mouth right now. And so they spliced it in so many different ways to probably make it justify whatever they're thinking. But, you know, you elect us to think and to make decisions. You have enough information in your constitution as an individual and as a leader to know what side you need to come on these tough issues. They're tough decisions. So this poll was difficult to really get anything out of, because the more I spliced it, the more I realized, oh, you could use this to justify any argument you have. Mm-hmm. But it did point out one consistent pattern, which is District 1, which is one of the beauties of this new form of government, where we were going to finally give more representation to our most marginalized part of Portland. They once again were underrepresented in the polling, and their point of view was very different than, say, District 3. Mm-hmm. And so in District 1, where we have some of the biggest needs for services, especially in response to high crime, they're saying, yes, we want police. We're prioritizing that. So I like that it once again reminded us, if we care about equity, if we care about those who are the least among us, and they're saying they want police, listen to them.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking about that too. Like, the district level highlights from the poll were really interesting, because I live in District 3, and District 3 to me is very divided between a District 1 lower income type is kind of where I live, and then there's the inner east side of District 3, which I would identify with Angelita's kind of more wealthy. You know, she's making, I don't know, 150 grand now, so obviously she's in that camp, but they didn't want more police. So it's like, you really see the district level needs for public safety, like you said, like District 1. And I believe the other one was it 4 or 2? But you really get to see the district level.
The most diverse neighborhoods.
Wants and needs versus the more wealthy ones.
Yeah. I mean, they're crime victims.
Yes. And then when they prioritize it a different way, instead of like pitting two against each other, but they said, when push comes to shove, what do you want to make sure we keep intact? And then public safety and police went right up to the top again.
Right.
So I think basic needs are public safety, and there is violent crime. There is complex crime in Portland, and you have to have a sophisticated unit within a bureau that does this type of work. And that happens to be the Portland Police Bureau.
What about the argument that Councillor Samir Kanal is arguing that Portland Street Response, which was, my understanding of it, conceived of by former city councilor Joanne Hardesty as part of the goal to reduce police. I mean, she was, in my opinion, the head of the Defund the Police movement and part of leading the charge on that to defund them twice. And of course, you came on council when they were voting to defund the police for the second round, and you voted against it. And so what is the What are your thoughts about Portland Street Response as its own bureau? Because I think police, we were talking off air. We both have heard from police that they don't want to take all the calls they're getting. They do want help. I think alternatives to a traditional police response are popular in Portland. What are your thoughts about a new bureau that's a Portland Street Response bureau separate and apart from police?
The dynamics of public safety by anyone in the police bureau. I've never talked to a police officer who haven't said they want to open up to what that can look like to be additive to what the police
that's
do.
That's my experience too.
And so what I would say to Councillor Canall is that we need to take a breath and reset this. Because the way Portland Street Response, first of all, we do not have the funds nor the bandwidth right now to insert a new bureau.
Because there's a shortfall.
Guys heard there's a huge budget
shortfall. Yeah, there's a huge budget deficit.
Can you give us an understanding of what kinds of dollars we're talking about?
Yeah, I was going to ask too, to just give people an idea of what it takes to create a bureau.
Yeah, right. Millions. Huge because budget. You have all this infrastructure that has, you know,
become, you need staff.
So. We need to
look at your guns. Your hands were just over your head. Holy cow. We can talk about your workout routine later.
Oh, please. I'll start talking about my sciatic nerve pain. This will be a really good episode. So they're like, we need the Portland Street. Any alternative has to be additive to police. But the way that it was framed was always an alternate to police. Like, police is bad. This is good. We need more of this.
Yeah.
And stop it. That's just not what grownups do. We have very complex public safety issues in this city. We have police officers that would like additive responses to some calls that don't require somebody to show up in the way that they do with a gun, because they have guns on them because there's a violent the information given suggests that you should not enter into this case, into this theater of work here without it, because they have guns. So Portland Street Response couldn't go to that anyway. So we're talking about responses that would require some thoughtful scenarios on when you would deploy street response. But when do you deploy the county's Project Respond? So we have other units.
I think people forget that exists.
Yeah, so the county has Project Responds, which is really similar in terms of what they respond to, which is when there's mental health, behavioral health episodes taking place and someone needs a first responder to check in with them, Project Respond has the skill sets to connect with those people on the street. Chat from Fire has a similar way of saving taxpayers money by being responsive to the needs of somebody that kind of needs like an emergency triage on the street. So the truth is we have similar alternative responses, if you will, that are additive to police and fire. And if we want to mix Portland Street Response into that, let's have the strategic conversation about how each would be deployed. And let's figure out that choreography before we scale up something that we aren't ready to receive yet.
Right, because my understanding is 911 calls are coming in generally for all these things. There is not, I mean, people are being told there's no separate line for these kinds of things. Call 911. The calls have increased, but we don't have the resources. We don't have the resources, but we also just don't have them all working together.
Well, Portlanders are frustrated because they make the call. It takes a while to...
Well, they're being told to, yeah.
Right. And someone picks up now because we've dealt with their overtime issue by adding staff at BOAC. So
that's Bureau of Emergency Communications.
What we did at BOAC is this game plan that we need to do for police. We were in halfway there probably with fire.
And that worked.
Yeah, you're adding FTE and that brings down overtime. So we've done that with BOAC. We're making headway in fire.
FTE is full-time employees.
Full-time equivalent employees. Yeah. And we need to do that with police. Mm-hmm. So... Where are we? What was the question?
Well, people are calling. The calls are being answered.
Yes.
But then there's some difficulty about how to deploy people.
There's delay because of the not having enough staffing. And there's also the big issue, which brings up the county once again, is where do the police take somebody?
Yeah, well, at this public safety forum that I moderated, I actually asked that question. I said, look, people want to know what happens when they call police and you've got somebody in the middle of an addiction or mental health crisis. And you could, you're in this space where maybe there's not something criminal going on that's to the level of taking them, arresting them. What resources, if any, do you have? And both Nathan Vasquez, the Multnomah County DA, and Aaron Schmaltz, who's the head of the police union, said, we have virtually none. And that was a quote. And they both agreed on that. Virtually none.
So just let that sink in for a minute. So the mayor, the chair, the DA, the police chief, the sheriff, and all the commissioners and all the city council members should be involved in a summit on public safety, period. Because it's not just the city. We have an underfunded jail. We have underfunded prosecutions.
Yeah, 250 beds.
We have underfunded treatment centers. So there's nowhere to take people. That's one of our biggest challenges.
Right, even if you want help.
And the county oversees the budget for that. And the chair of county government, beginning with Kafori, has been disinvesting in public safety at a pretty big rate. And the former DA seemed to be okay with that. So now we have a DA that would like to actually prosecute again when people do crime. And he's taking leadership and he's making it really crisp and clear what it would take for him to do his job. He won by a decent amount countywide. We need to listen to him. He has a mandate to be successful. And for us to deny his very pragmatic strategy on how to improve the system is unconscionable to me. Mm-hmm. So I think that those of us on city council and at the county should come together, beg of our mayor and county chair to work together, just like they're trying to do with homelessness, because both of them are handoffs and have a lot of fumbles, period. And that's what we have to eliminate.
That's a football term. I'm just kidding.
That makes sense.
I thought it was pickleball.
No, I think that makes total sense. Yeah. And I like the summit idea. I do think, you know,
what is wrong with us? Why are we operating
Nathan,
in silos?
Nathan hasn't even been there a year, and to have, you know, your budget and your kind of strategy taken out from under your feet.
Oh, just kneecap.
This early is...
Why are we operating in silos? You've been in city government for a while. This is your... What is this? Is this your second term?
This is my fifth year.
Yes, my right.
Second, it's actually my third, but who cares? Like, I just have to run for re-election all the time because... charters changes.
True. That's true. So can you...
Don't worry, people. I won't be on the ballot for another 3 years.
Talk to us about why aren't we working together?
Great question. I remember when I was looking into running back in 2019 or 2020, someone said, Dan, you're really a team player.
And
you like to build teams to paddle in the same direction. We'll talk about dragon boats later. And... What I learned is a lot of elected officials, I don't know why they do this in local government, but a lot of people are trying to get into the big leagues, which I guess is like being, you know,
into Congress,
like Congress or something.
And by the way, everyone sees that, by the way, and you're not hiding it. It's not secret. I'm not saying you're doing it, but anyone who's on city council that's trying that, we can see right through that. So
I'm assuming that's what all the speeches.
It's like, this is our job. Like, your mission is to improve the services that we serve Portland. And we've been failing at that quite badly over the last X amount of years.
But it's like, that's not sexy or something. Because we were talking about this off air, and you were saying, I am tasked with making sure the services get to my city services that my constituents are paying taxes into get to my constituents.
Yeah.
And
because I heard it almost like every door, especially anyone that pays a mortgage. They're just like, I'm so tired of my bill going up. And my service is going down. When that happens with my cell phone carrier, you get a new one. You know,
right.
you have market choice. You go somewhere else. So that's why people have been moving. That's why businesses have been moving.
And why we have this budget shortfall.
It's like, oh, you're invoicing me more than all these neighboring jurisdictions.
Because we're losing
revenue.
Which
eats into my profits. Mm-hmm. And even though I love Portland because I'm a fourth generation Portlander, and it breaks my heart to leave, I'm going to exit. I'm finally going over to Clark County. I'm going to go out to the outer edges of Clackamas County. That's what's been happening. And so I just see revenue leaving the city left and right. And so I'm trying to think, as a legislator now that will have to respond to the mayor's budget, I'm thinking about those helpers. We need helpers right now to not leave Portland. We need people that come to Portland, that generate revenue, that hire people, that bring in, right, currency and revenue to our city, which goes to the very services that I think everyone wants. And so some, I think, see the pathway to get those investments through taxing, more targeted taxes. And some of us, like me, think the best way to get that revenue is to generate it from the ground up like we always have to be a prosperous city. And that's in business licenses, the property taxes. That gives you more bread and butter revenue to pay for all your services. So we have to be really mindful right now to focus on those key basics that would allow people to trust this city council and this mayor is rational enough to do everything they can to save our city from the doom loop.
Do you think the majority of city council agrees with you that we're in a doom loop?
I don't think so, actually. No,
I don't either. I don't either. Isn't it?
But it won't stop me from saying what I think.
Well, it's even being reported as fact. I mean, it's just a fact.
Yeah. I was going to say,
what's a fact?
Well, that we are losing revenue, yeah.
I mean, I look at data. I've always been a data driven leader. Yeah. It's like, here's the data. And I think some of us just think they can tax their way out of it. And my most liberal, generous friends that I never thought I'd hear from them, I'm done paying higher taxes. I'm hearing that from people that I never thought I'd hear that from.
Well, I was going to say, I know that even if they disagree with that there is a doom loop, I've sat there and watched the Permitting Bureau's presentation about how permits have just plummeted. And that's, you know, another reason why we don't have a lot of money is because there's not a lot of permits being issued, because, you know, businesses, housing, any of that stuff. And that generates a ton of revenue for our city. So even if they disagree with it, I know they've had to sit through those presentations that say the revenue's not coming in because
it doesn't pencil out.
There's not a reputation here to do it, you know.
Well, you know, when we talk about the housing shortage, you look at cities, especially like Austin's the one that we always like to compare ourselves to. They've been doing tons of building.
Well, and by the way, their city council budget is a fraction
of
what ours. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Almost every city council budget. Of similar
is there a similar
a fraction?
There's okay. apples and oranges sometimes, but because of the water bureau and sewer, that kind of throws things off a bit.
But they're
a similar or even bigger population, right?
Yeah.
My point is they focused on supply.
Right.
And when you focus on supply, your rents go down and the availability goes up. So we aren't building. So it's a supply and demand issue.
Yeah, I don't know how many times I can put up.
And I don't think an algorithm like...
Banning, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these solutions looking for problems are just not going to get us out of this.
Yeah, putting more restrictions on housing is not something we need to be doing right now. And I was going to say, I don't know how many, you know, on my show, I always put up the graphic that Willamette Week did of we're in the 10-year slump of apartment construction, kind of historic low for housing starts and apartments.
I mean, my understanding is that the budget hole is, what, $100 million?
Yeah.
Around
that. And there's some buckets of that. But the biggest one, the one that you can control the most, is to improve the livability of the city so people stop leaving and attracting investors. And right now, we're the 80th perception of where to invest nationally from people that invest in big housing, invest in big projects. We're 80th out of 81. We're only ahead of Hartford, Connecticut. And before all of this, like in 2018, we were number 3.
Wow.
So that says everything right there. Mm-hmm. Like, people just aren't that into us right now. Like, it's like dating. When you're dating somebody, they're not like, accept it.
Yeah.
And then figure out what you can do to improve upon yourself so you can get back in the game. So Portland, you're not really that hot right now.
Yeah.
And so we have to figure out how to look in the mirror and make ourselves attractive so that we can actually have a reputation that starts to go up and we can start to have revenue in. And then we can look at some of these very innovative programs. Mm-hmm. But right now, we have to focus on the basics.
So our budget from 24-25 in Portland, $8 billion. Austin's budget, $5.9 billion.
Okay.
What is their population? Nearly 1,979,882. What's ours? 630,498. That's our population. I mean, riddle me that.
I can't.
It's wild.
Yeah.
But almost every city in the country is like this, of similar size. And they also have police. Somehow they're able to fund their police.
And they're still weird, right? Don't they have like a Keep Austin Weird?
Yeah. I think they're,
so like it could be weird and also be entrepreneurial.
There's a whole rivalry. Time. You know that whole story about like some people think that the slogan originated in Austin. There's a whole
everyone from Texas does believe that that's
what it is. I don't know what the real story is, but
I guess the point is, that's right. You can be a blue city,
right,
and fund your police.
Yeah, and you can have basic livability government functioning.
Well, that's why I thought that question at the safety seminar that I moderated was so interesting, because I agree that it's an interesting question, but see, in most cities in the United States, I don't think it would be asked. I just don't think people conflate civility with the right wing. I think they just assume their city's going to work. And if they call the police, like Joanne Hardesty called the police, like the woman who led the charge to defund the police called the police and was upset when, you know, she didn't get the response that she felt like she was entitled to. But let's hope not. But if you do need them, you do want them to come. I mean, if you have a violent, if you're the victim of a violent crime.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I see.
What did they think Portland Street Response is going to do with the guy with the knives in the tent?
Go ahead.
Yeah. This is good. I think what I'm experiencing is when I was sworn into office in 2020, it was obviously a moment in time.
I can't imagine.
And the racial justice protests were supposed to happen, in my opinion, all over the country. I do think that the city of Portland is lingering with that longer than anyone else, right?
And so we have the longest amount of riots, 180 plus nights.
Right.
With the longest in the country.
Protests turned into riots.
The whitest big city in America.
Yes. And the dynamic was so odd because police are supposed to do crowd control at protest to keep both sides safe. But it's unprecedented that you're doing that and you're protecting yourself, because the protest was at them, directly at them. And we've just have to move on, because we are reforming the police. We are reforming public safety. Let's have the courage to methodically do that. Let's stay at the table, bring conversations about Portland Street Response, but stop doing it in a shameful adversarial way. These are public servants that are out there risking their lives to protect Portlanders every day. They have to make such tough decisions. That's why I said the people in the Police Accountability Commission should do ride-alongs. They need to have some understanding of what their jobs are like, not a version that comes to them from a blog that they read or from their own experience 20 years ago.
It makes me wonder, is that a requirement for city councilors? Because it seems like it should be to do a ride-along.
So.
I hope that is.
No, it's absolutely not a requirement. I agree it should be.
The Department of Justice work that's been going on with police that started, was that right after 2000?
Are you talking about the consent decree?
Just the whole, all of the work that evolved from the DOJ's work that started with Portland's 2011.
Right, well, I mean, it started with them saying we did not have a racial justice problem, that we had a mental illness, a treatment of people with mental illness problem. But again, it was a consent decree. Yes. In other words, the city raised their hand. Really, I mean, the whole thing is interesting. It's not like we did something and there was a spotlight on us because we needed to be investigated. We raised our own hand.
We did.
And said, please come audit us. Please come investigate us, because we think we've got this disparate treatment in regard to people who identify as minorities who get tangled up in the criminal justice system. And the answer to that question was, you don't. You're good on that front. Your issue is with the mentally ill. And so this is the consent decree that we think you should enter into. And the city said, great, we'll kind of sign whatever you want. And yet
the focus, I'm getting this right now as I'm listening to you. So it was about mental health.
Yes.
And who is the jurisdiction that oversees mental health for the state of Oregon?
Well, that would be Multnomah County.
Yes. And so
Behavioral Health.
So the mission creep began there. And like at that moment, that would have been the time to bring in the county, back to earlier dialogue about public safety being a city-county partnership. And so that seems to be a failure here. And so we keep putting it in this adversarial deficit posture. Police are bad. They have to be reformed. And I do think that our police has evolved. I hear it from officers that were at other police jurisdictions around the country, and they're so glad to be in Portland. It's known as the most progressive police bureau.
Yeah, I mean, the list of things they can't do is 20 miles long. Most people don't understand that, but it's true. I mean, we've already hamstrung them. You know, there's a million things they can't do that we've gotten rid of and told them that they're not allowed to do.
And of all of our bureaus, it's by far has the most checks and balances and accountability. Like I would say,
oh my God, there's so many levels of police accountability. It would blow your mind.
When the mayor tossed me into the homeless with the county, I told him, I'm like, God, if we could just have a fraction of the accountability we have for police for the homeless industry.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine what success we'd start to see?
Talk to us about that, because you started the Safe Rest Villages in the city of Portland. You did an end run around the county effectively. You did it, and you developed all these Safe Rest Villages, which had, my understanding is, amazing success rates.
They did when they were implemented with the fidelity in which they were planned for. It's really important to notice the difference in how they're being operated. So the city operates some and the county operates some. And once again, you're seeing that lack of coordination between the two entities on this.
Even though we have a joint office of homeless services, which means the city we're writing them a check. To administer.
We're the donor with little influence. Like we're the donor to that office, have been forever. It used to be the biggest donor before SHS funds, with like little responsibility.
And the SHS funds,
little accountability, little authority. Housing. That's the right word. Little authority.
Supportive housing services tax that Metro, the third layer of government, runs, which is a tri-county operation.
Try to follow along here, folks.
Yeah.
Right? Multnomah County, Washington County, Clackamas County. That's the SHS. I mean, again, another layer of government nobody's talking to.
We're supposed to do this in the villages and the task sites. Why they're in there, it's like an assessment period. And they're supposed to get hooked in to behavioral health and mental health services. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to get into workforce if they're capable.
And they were when you were administering the program as the bureau director.
But I got it taken away in 2023. The mayor put it into Rubio's camp. And increasingly, it was hard to be that annoying person with influence, the elected, because I didn't have that authority any longer. But early on, that was the whole plan, was to ensure that you were focusing on behavioral health, mental health, and workforce. If you were meeting those marks, then let's say you would graduate into stable housing. You'd get into one of the affordable housing units with case management. What I wanted to stop was putting people into housing only to have them back on the streets in 30 days to 3 months.
Well, or to have them die indoors.
Yeah.
So many of them die indoors. I mean, Tom Wolf in San Francisco. Wolf.
Yeah, the whole isolation thing. Yeah, because when you're an addict, you need connection. And so putting people into a single occupancy unit is probably one of the worst things you can do with somebody that's untreated, because you're going to go officially crazy and ransack the place and could end up in squalor and then end up dying, like you reported, especially when the new, more poisonous drugs were hitting the market.
Like fentanyl. Exactly. And I just think people...
That's why that report's so high now. It's because of drugs.
Right. I just think people need to go back and listen to your first episode. But for people who haven't, I think it's very important to understand that you have personal experience with this because of your brother, who...
Yeah.
Passed away.
I saw the need in 2014. Use. It started in 2010. It's like when Tim, actually when he was in jail for like, say, 30 days, because he did something bad to continue his habit of heroin at the time, he would withdraw. And he had this much time. I'm doing this little thing with my hand, like not much time, a window to get in there and get into treatment. There was never any treatment offered. That's exactly when you're supposed to offer it. Mm-hmm. Tim was a very good worker. He could get back into the workforce. It would take a lot of support with the case manager, but that's somebody that could have went from being dependent on government services to being independent of government services and being a provider again. So that's the whole equation. Back to the economy, back to economic development. We have too many people from the ages of 25 to 55 on our streets doing drugs that are dependent on government. And we need them to be back into the workforce, providing again for
Dependent on government, but we're not even offering them the off ramps that they need. We don't. If you want to get sober, you can't get it.
That's another thing. And back to that, you know, we talked about this Portland Street response in some conversation where finally we're trying to contract this out in labor talks. But the fact that they can meet people where they are. Okay, it's fine, Portland. Meet people where they are, but don't leave them there. Like, that's inhumane to leave people where they are.
And I think, I know you don't like to talk about yourself, but I just think it's important that people understand that you work a sobriety program, and it's not like you, it's not like you have absolutely zero personal perspective about this. I know you don't like to talk about yourself.
No, but I think it's important to the many people out there that are living one day at a time, working a program, what we know is that it takes a lot of accountability and responsibility to be sober one day at a time. And so you just start to expect that from others.
Does the city need to do another end run around the county and just do the kind of thing Keith Wilson wants to do?
Well, the city's budget challenges are a big part, because we're funding social services that really should be at the county. Mm-hmm. And that mission creep started a while ago, and I think it really did. I think the DOJ case is actually a really good moment in time. I think the city's frustration, especially during COVID, that it was always housing first and housing only, the housing first agenda. People like me started to say, that's a little dated. That was written before fentanyl, before the new meth. It was written a while ago. And so it wasn't written with the amount of behavioral health issues that we're seeing on our streets today. Everyone knows.
And it was written with a continuum of care in mind, right? Yeah. With services in mind.
It was. But this whole idea that just by putting someone into an apartment, everything's right. going to be fine is just not, it's not valid.
It's not
money.
Current, you know, like you said, with these new drugs. The way that you were describing it a second ago, I think is the most successful model. Do you call that a, I always forget the name, Housing Zero? What do they call it?
Oh, Built for Zero, Sharon Myron.
Do you call that a Built for Zero?
Yeah, in fact, my first phone call outside of City Hall when I got elected in 2020 was to the woman who runs that program back east. I met her a long time ago. She lives in Boston. And she warned me, this is in 2017 when I met her in Charlotte. I said, why aren't you working with Multnomah County? And she rolled her eyes. She goes, I've tried. They think they know everything.
Right.
So there's this, that's when I say Portland can be really smug mm-hmm. about thinking it knows everything. And yet I think we need to be a little bit more humble, because look around, clearly our plan didn't work.
Yeah, right.
And it's pretty far into it now. So we have to have the courage to rethink it. And I really hope that we can continue with a new mayor to be optimistic about those services, but then be pragmatic and realistic about how to move people to a better place. Mm-hmm. And we have to start having consequences. You can't keep offering carrots after carrots without any sticks, as right. they say.
Yeah, it just seems like that Built for Zero approach is the much more kind of updated. I don't know, anyone who's ever known an addict, it's like, yeah, like all the stuff you always are saying, you need to give them a pathway that includes employment, kind of a transitional approach to housing. It works for them and works for everybody. So,
and this whole notion that it doesn't travel, some people say come to Portland because it's an easy place. People know that. Mm-hmm. Like, I know when we were passing some legislation that I finally thought was being a little bit more rational in the last council, I noticed that when we really lobbied hard on the state and they finally redid Measure 110, that helped.
To recriminalize drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
Hard drugs.
This just said recriminalize drugs when you're doing them in public. And then I also think the sit lie ordinance that we passed that was really difficult to talk about, and yet we did, and we had the courage to land that legislation. And I think the current mayor is having some indigestion around that. And we use these slogans. Again, we use these slogans when we're talking about something really complex. Like, we don't want to criminalize homelessness. No one's saying to criminalize homelessness. Right, right. But if someone is sitting at someone's storefront for 5 days in a row and they won't move. Mm-hmm. And they're making it so their customers can't come in. They're making it so their employees don't feel safe to go to their car, to go outside to have a walk at lunch. That's just called criminal behavior.
Right.
It doesn't matter to me that they're homeless. They're doing criminal behavior in front of that storefront.
There's
so
no
we're
other
supposed
city.
To respond to that. Like yeah, this, again, it's like, are we really having this conversation? Yeah. Like, why is
you gotta
this?
Have boundaries, you know?
Yeah,
is this called rational in Portland? Is that the name of your
right?
Yeah.
Right.
So when we're rational, it's like we can't even believe we're having this conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
But there's no, I mean, that I can think of. It's a uniquely Pacific Northwest cultural issue. There's no other there's a little bit in Seattle, although they don't seem to have the allergy to business that we do, but there's nowhere else in the country where you can just try to pitch a tent in Times Square. Mm-hmm. Try to pitch a tent. Just try to do it. You know, they don't let you. They shelter. They're homeless. Mandatory sheltering in New York City, one of the biggest cities in the world. Well, we can't do it. You know, we got a housing shortage. Do you think New York City doesn't have a housing shortage? It's just so bizarre to me. Are we really trying to argue that our housing's more expensive? That we can't do it? That we can't
do
this? Do
you think my theater friends on Broadway are going to... Of course they need that. They need tourists to go to their Broadway shows. It's like they're mm-hmm. pragmatic enough to know this is how the economy of New York City
works. But Dan, like you and I know this, we have family members who have been homeless and passed away. I have a family member who's, you know, I got a call from a bill collector the other day, got a call from some court the other day that's got something pending against her. I don't know what it is, but wanting me to pay some money or weigh in on something, or it's just absolutely constant. Somebody, you know, family member, for me, it's my sister out on the streets, addicted to opioids. I'm actually really shocked that she isn't dead with fentanyl. But I think as family members, we want off ramps. I mean, we want our family members off the street. We don't want them languishing on the street. And we know that if you pitch a tent on a sidewalk, that usually means you've lost control of your life.
And we
something's wrong.
Oh, and we also know because of our life experience that we don't want to be one of the enablers any longer. Right. Yeah. And so when a family gets to that courageous place of doing tough love and not being an enabler, they'd like a partner in government to be there with them, not to counter them, to enable the behavior of their loved one.
Because
so that's where I got really, we all got
network.
Frustrated. It's like, right. Oh, great. I guess the city and the county doesn't care.
She's not
and they're
surfing.
Fine with my brother being out on the streets.
That's right. She's not him. Surfing on yeah. my couch. She wasn't surfing. He wasn't surfing on your couch. They burned through their support network. They've drained the bank account one too many times.
Right.
Like, we know where the money goes.
Yes.
The $5 isn't going to a sandwich. We could be responsible for killing them. We know what's happening. We're clued into it. We can't force them into treatment.
And this conversation gets us back to the fact that this is a city county season of budgets. We need better coordination between the city and the county, and the county needs to fund these services. So why you're thinking about testifying to the city, please go across the river to the county building. Have people's backs, like right now, Julie Brim Edwards is making a lot of sense, along with the former commissioner.
Yeah,
Byward.
Like to fund, Julie Brim Edwards would like to fund something besides needles and pipes and
yeah,
foil.
That's what I was going to say, you know.
That's where all the money's
historically
going.
Yeah, the county's been the one kind of being the enablers, handing out pipes or whatever. You know.
I mean, they started handing out tents again, yeah. You know, just.
You can tell.
And that's the last thing you want is your government being the enablers of what we were just talking about, you know, so.
But I think with public safety and homeless and mental health and behavioral health, please get to the county
right.
and share your stories, share your personal stories, tell them what you've experienced living in Portland over the last 10 years.
Well, the county is one of the easiest places to testify because you really can just show up. That I mean, that day, if you want,
you
sign
don't have
in.
To pre-appoint, make an appointment.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they would like you to, but you
well,
can
good.
Just
let's,
walk in
let's,
and sign in.
Let's take advantage of that and have a lot of people go and testify mm-hmm. there as well, because these budgets have to connect the dots with one another.
Your former deputy chief of staff was just in there testifying. I did an episode with her, and I put her testimony at the end, her county testimony about homelessness. That
Jill
should Swade. It should be up now. Yeah, Jill good. Swade about. Just saying, look, your budget's growing and growing and growing, and we still don't see any funding for behavioral health or mental health. And it's I think people are frustrated.
Well, we're compassionate people, and we see what we see. We can't
look, if I were
it.
On the street, I wouldn't want to be. I would want somebody to help me off.
And we have to testify at TriMet as well.
So talk about that.
I didn't even know you could do that.
Well, they have a board.
Yeah, they have a board. I learned that from you.
Yeah, and there's, I'll just say it. So either. The yellow line going out to Delta Park, the lines that go out to Gateway, if you ride those lines, what you'll notice is it's the number one provider of transportation services for people who are homeless.
Okay.
And I don't think anyone would disagree with me on that. And it's also a vehicle, if you will, transportation that connects dots between drug trade.
Mm.
And so you can see those services being offered when you get off at some stops.
Sure.
What's stopping the TriMet and county's outreach workers, and we need to get the city's public safety systems in this network as well, since we know that's where like the biggest impact in terms of the number of people who are homeless, who are doing some bad things, are doing them sometimes on the light rail and then their stops where they get off. Where's the people on the train that are currently there, but could they do something? I think their only thing they do, I hear this from my spouse, they'll go like this. Are you okay? And they're like sleeping, right? Well, first of all, who's going to be okay if you're like sound asleep on whatever drugs and someone pounds on your seat? So of course they're not okay after that.
Right.
And then they don't do anything with them. Of course they say, I'm fine, because they don't want to talk to this person. Instead, they should be like, hey, let's have a conversation. Hey, I'm going to have you talk to this outreach worker at the next stop and let's get you hooked into some services.
Right.
Where's that type of effort?
Because you're saying the
I just asked TriMet myself.
Safety, it seems like an obvious.
Yeah. The TriMet safety people that are doing that? Is that what you're
doing? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I was just, I don't know, you could probably put a link in, but I just saw the thing this weekend that I think it was on the Oregonian that ridership's down again and all that stuff.
That's what I want to talk about. Yeah. Isn't it down 30%?
It was, yeah, from 2019 levels.
Exactly.
And it's like, that's the stuff I always want to tell. You know, I heard Steve Novick talking about trying to get people out of cars the other day, and I always just think, they're not going to go on public transit when they don't feel safe and there's all this stuff going on.
So when I talk to the climate crusaders about this, I say, well, wouldn't you want to focus on the fact that TriMet ridership is down by 30%?
Right.
Like, wouldn't that be one of the best initiatives that you could focus on? Why is it that they don't want to talk about that? They want to criminalize homelessness.
That's true.
Like, see what they do? You take you take a nonsensical slogan and attach it here so you can once again avoid the real issue.
Yeah.
The real issue is that it will be good for our climate if more people were taking mass transportation again. We used to have like a celebrated mass transportation system.
I loved the MAX.
Now we have the one that's known to have the biggest decrease in ridership nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good.
But you're right. It,
that's not good for our climate.
Ridership remains down. This is, Andy, what you're talking about. This morning, TriMet ridership remains down by a third from 2019, and the recovery is slowing. 30 million fewer rides each year than it did in 2019. That's crazy.
So when I've asked activists why
in the metro area,
why do you think it is? You're going to hear from some of the lobby that it's because of the cost. Well, first of all, most of those people that they're waking up haven't paid a penny. They haven't paid fares.
Yeah.
So the real issue, I know it. I just know why people aren't riding it. It's because it's dirty, it smells, and they don't feel safe.
Yeah, and there's been...
It says rider safety has been a persistent concern. A survey last fall found nearly half of respondents said they don't want to ride the MAX because of safety. And you and I have talked about this, but I just think it's important to remind people, if you have a high schooler within Portland Public School District, how do they get to high school? I mean, those of us who don't have high school, I have one next year. Those of us who aren't thinking about that, you know, maybe it's not maybe they don't know this, but they don't have a school bus. They have to take public transportation. And I know students in this neighborhood that take public transportation to public and private schools. And they see things like people with bags of needles sitting across from them. These are children. You know, I think people forget 14, 15, like they start high school here, freshmen. So that's ninth grade. 14, 15 year olds, they're little.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to do this themselves. You know, take it into downtown, take it into Southeast Portland and Northeast Portland, wherever they're going. They did a TriMet study wondering what fentanyl smoke does to drivers. And this is where we're putting our kids.
Well, there's also the old
nobody's writing it, but the kids have to
study that meth and fentanyl residue was on like every TriMet bus and Max. And so there's all this data that points to why people aren't on it. But I think you were right, Dan, when you're saying,
but where's the action plan?
When people get into that, hey, are you criminalizing homelessness? They kind of just fall off the whole conversation because they think that that's what's happening. When it's not, it's really,
I mean, this is the best. Safety
issue. Yeah, we grabbed that slogan because it seems to resonate well with most people, but it means absolutely nothing in that conversation that we're having right now.
Right.
We're just talking about wanting to increase ridership because it's good for the environment. Mm-hmm. It's good for our city. Do you know what type of first impression we put on people that land at the airport and get on the Max?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Oh, you have a story?
Yes, I do. Well, I don't know. I don't know about a story, but just take. Yes, there's getting on the Max from Portland, but also just, you know, get in your car and start driving to wherever you need to go from the airport towards Portland, not towards Vancouver, USA, towards Portland. I counted the other day coming from the airport. My kids and I were just counting like how many seconds went by before we saw a tent. I think we got to 20. Just one tent, though. I mean, but there's hundreds.
But these are first impressions. So we have this beautiful renovated airport. It just couldn't be more stunning.
It is weirdly beautiful.
And you get out of that airport.
It was the one thing, Dan, that we did not need to renovate in this city was that airport. It was the nicest thing about this city. I just want to get this out. We've always had a nice airport. It's always
this reminds me of curbs.
It's always been number one, is it not?
I mean, it was rated, it's by like beautiful. Condé Nast or something. But yes, the new terminal is.
Oh, it's crazy. You know, what do? We improve the flipping airport.
But let's say that's still good. It's good. We have a beautiful airport. Can we just say it? And so what we'd like is when they get, they go to the Max train and it's clean and they feel safe and they get downtown and they have a lovely walk to their hotel room. Mm-hmm. Like that used to be Portland. Not that long ago. This started probably around 2012 where people started having incidents like that. And so I think we've just been in denial about these issues for a long time, and no one has time for it anymore. If you're going to run for office at this time, just get rid of your traditional slogans and the political like industry that you're attached to, and serve with courage to get this city back on track. I'm sorry, this is my hometown. This isn't a political job for me. This is a job to be a public servant, to do everything I can to get us back on track so we can be a rational city once again that's open and inclusive to all people. That's what we want to be. That's always been Portland's vibe. Mm-hmm. It's still there. I know it's still there. It's in our DNA. And again, we're the most beautiful place you could find in the country. This is a beautiful place to live. And I just can't watch it in my elder years here just continue to crumble into political slogans and just being like a staging for another cause for what? Like, people, wake up. We can do this. We have an energetic mayor. Everyone got behind him because they want to see unsheltered homelessness. And great, check. That's a good motivation. Now we just need to wake up the new city council to stop bringing all these solutions, looking for problems and part of their platform policies that they're performing for and say, sounds interesting, but meanwhile, this isn't Congress. Salem.
People are rotting and dying on the streets of your city. And what will you do about
this? This city, it's about infrastructure. It's about pipes and streets and public safety, and do your job. Because guess what? All of those things need to improve. And your job is to see that through right now. Mm-hmm. I got a little heated. For me.
For you.
I would love to see, like, we spent many years kind of experimenting on different measures and different ideas, and I think the time for that's over. We need to kind of just do the back to basics, government basic stuff.
And I'm hoping that's what I'm going to see from the mayor's budget.
I
have hope. I do. I have hope that the budget that comes out from Mayor Wilson will be a back to basics budget.
Yeah.
And I hope that that can then be protected and passed. And then we can wake up the county to remember what their primary responsibilities are as well. Mm-hmm. And they have primary responsibilities in mental health, behavioral health, and public safety in terms of treatments and corrections and prosecutions.
Right.
And you're failing miserably at all of those. Mm-hmm. So We can all just accept that we're failing. And when you can accept with honesty that you're failing, you have nowhere to go but up. And then you can start paddling in the right direction. And you use data like the Doom report that made very compelling case for the fact that we are now here and we can get out. But we're not going to get out if we continue to behave in a way that's anti-business and that we keep trying to come up with the new latest, I don't know, solution to some problem that people are looking for to look like we're, you know, ahead of Berkeley now in introducing experiments from, I don't know where these ideas come from, but we seem to be a testing ground for some.
We're guinea pigs. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's for not literally anything right
that's never been done before.
Just, and all the, yeah, the public safety stuff, we definitely don't want a round two of 2020 defunding any public safety.
We know what that looks like. Yeah. Highest amount of homicides, most dangerous place in America to be if you're Black.
And so
I mean, those headlines were horrible about your risk of being shot as a Black person in the city of Portland per capita. I mean, do you remember that? It was crazy. You were more likely to be shot as a Black person in the city of Portland than Seattle, Minneapolis, Baltimore.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not funny. It's bizarre. It's bizarre to even recount it.
Yeah, it's not a watermark.
The whitest big city in America.
Yeah.
And we profess to care about minorities. We say these are the people we care about the most. And this is what they're crime victims, but they're crime victims.
And we have to protect our fragile infrastructure. I mean, the report that came out from the auditor wasn't really that mind blowing. You could do the math what over the last 4 years. What was
the report?
It was that we have a big backlog of deferred maintenance. And every bureau has been talking about that for some time now.
Yeah.
So if you added all the bureau reports on this over the last 4 years, you would come up with $1 billion number. It's more that what's the action plan?
Right.
So in our budget, I want to be talking about that. I want to talk about what is going to be our discipline routine maintenance operations to start to chip away at that. How can we get the system development charges to be spent on deferred maintenance and not just new projects? That's a statute in the state that has to change. Like, what's the action plan to get at that? How many more times do we have to read another report that says we're not doing well? And then how many more times do we have to have a fits and starts study that says what we're supposed to do? And then how many times do we have to reject that study because it made us uncomfortable, or the political industry decided they didn't like it because it was going to take money away from their cause? Like, people, grow up. Like, this is really serious where we are right now. It's going to be hard to get out of a doom loop unless we take some decisive action. And I think our governor and our mayor are aligned on that pragmatic thinking. And so that makes me hopeful. And now we just need everybody else to start to just loosen up a bit. Stop taking yourself so seriously about your upcoming congressional campaign in a decade from now, and know that you're a member of the Portland City Council in 2025.
Right.
You're a member of Multnomah Commission in 2025. And this is the reality. Are you going to squander this opportunity to be a focused, courageous leader and do what's right to get our city back on track? Are you going to perform for your lobby to pass your policies that allow you to be celebrated in that small lobby that has a lot of noise so that you can continue on your wonderful political career? I just don't care. Yeah, it's
about outrageous sound bites.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what will happen is Portland will suffer in those folks' political career will maybe be extended, but yeah, it's not going to help the city.
It's about vanity and headlines. It's just really
these jobs shouldn't be partisan. This is just right. These are independent jobs.
I just think it's important everybody understand care. That. Yeah, these are nonpartisan positions. Mayor is nonpartisan. City councilor is nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. Multnomah County Commission is nonpartisan. Multnomah County Chair is nonpartisan.
In my head, any deviation from that is a distraction, just stay focused on local livability, city stuff, and that's what you need to focus on. But I was going to shout you out because I thought, I don't know if you felt like targeted by the auditor in that thing, but I've always felt like ever since I've talked to you and listened to you, that you were the one that's focused on, hey, this backlog is getting ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're the most vocal. It seems like maybe to me you are. But also, your experience being a commissioner before this, I think definitely lends credence to that. And I just don't hear a lot of it from the young, very young city council members about that stuff. Like, you've been very vocal about it for a long time and aware of it and proactive.
They'll probably find their voice and just say, oh, that's because of the last council.
Right.
When it's like, no, that just means.
It's a lot of that.
We all need to focus on this.
It's a lot of that. But like right now, even when you responded to that K2 thing, like, you were the only one that had, hey, here's some actual things we can work on right now to start being proactive with this. And I don't hear that from anyone else. Maybe Eric, I guess. But
I can't help it. You know, I was always an executive type leader. So you accept the problem as what it is.
Right.
And then you figure out what's the action steps that you can take to move to a better place. It's always more incremental and less silver bullety and quick fixy than I think people want. That's just a challenge we all have in the United States of America.
Yeah.
And, but you can do it.
Right.
And I think there's just this lack of acceptance of just how challenging these times are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's pride or what gets in the way of us just being honest with our problem and how we can all just come together and move forward.
It's a bill. It's a billion dollar.
It's a billion.
Infrastructure maintenance backlog.
But, you know, when you're
billion with a B,
I've been here long enough and I've had roles in the city before being elected, and I was on the school board, you know, a couple decades ago. And, you know, after a while, it just gives you knowledge and experience. Mm-hmm.
But this is basic stuff. I just think it's important people understand. It's like water and sewer.
It's super basic infrastructure stuff.
Yeah. And those are in restricted accounts. And that's where the general fund conversations get difficult, because it pits general services against each other. And public safety, of course, is the most expensive and the largest. And parks. And so they just all start, you know, competing with each other. But the thing is, it's like, you don't, with this, you don't get that. So it's kind of hypothetically, if our public safety continues to erode, that, in my opinion, will cause more exits out of Portland, which means less revenue. And that's the cycle we're trying to get out of.
Right.
So it kind of, I have a lot of faith that the mayor's budget is going to prioritize public safety. I'm looking for an increase, not the same price, because again, if we don't increase staffing, we're going to continue to be in this overtime drama.
And we don't want to pay overtime. We just want to pay for full-time police officers.
But I don't need a line item that says no more overtime and then no more staffing. That's just called defund the police with a whole new strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Got it? And then when you add Portland Street Response as a new bureau to that, forget about it. You're going to see a decline in the number of police officers.
We don't have enough credit cards to pay for that. But
well, and I think some governmental level was just the subject of another phishing scam or something.
Yeah, there was. Yeah, it was like a.
Can we knock it off with this? It's like.
Losing. It is ridiculous, but it's also like, you know, we're in the age of sophisticated scammers.
But this is what I expect now, too, from the enterprise. So there used to be that time.
But it's just like an oh, well.
Yeah.
Commissioners would have, you know, jurisdiction over certain parts of the enterprise at any given time. Then the mayor would switch around. We all know that that needed to stop. But now we have to have a city manager and a mayor that has the courage and the willingness to really shake up that enterprise. And so when we had a phishing incident in 2022, what did we learn from that? And were those practices in place where it just occurred? And if they weren't, we need to know why they weren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody ever looks at it. Nobody ever looks. It's just like, well, we lost another however many
this
millions.
This one, supposedly, they might be able to claw back. I don't think the other one they were able to, but this is way more. So I don't know.
Let's hope so.
And this is going on everywhere.
It is.
So what are we learning from each other to make sure this doesn't happen again in the future? How do you keep up with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we, budget-wise, do we have enough infrastructure in our IT security bureau or office that can allow us to stay on the cutting edge of how to play defense here?
I mean, this is the snoozy, quote-unquote snoozy stuff that you have to worry about as a city councilor, it turns out.
Yes, it is.
Where did our money go? And how do we keep it from flying out of the wallet?
And I actually think of those people as the experts. First of all, can we just talk about that word, experts?
Yes, let's do. It bugs me a lot.
Me too.
I'm just one of those, like, I'm kind of.
That's my new least favorite word. Yeah, why is it for you?
I cannot agree more. I'm just over it. You know, it's. I think a lot of people got frustrated post 2020 with using that word. I don't know what that means to you guys,
yeah.
But
yeah, I think that's right.
People lost a lot of trust with classical authorities because
We allegedly followed them, and that's allegedly our schools ended up being closed for 18 months. Right. So.
But that's how I'm
in a lot of different things.
But with the word is being used a lot,
right?
At council now, they have presenters that come in from outside the city,
right?
That are sometimes professors in faraway lands that want to tell us why something's good, and they're experts because they have a PhD, which is fine, I guess. But it just
no, Dan, it bugs me so much. Right, I know the Zoom calls you're talking about, and I'll just be like, "What in the hell do you have to say about Portland? You don't even live here, you know? These guys are like,
yeah, you're dialing in from somewhere. You couldn't even be bothered to get on a plane
from an Ivy League university, which aren't even trusted that much anymore, from across." You know, from the East Coast or something, and it just doesn't relate to Portland.
Right. So when you hear an expert tell you why something they were saying why renewable fuels are now just as bad as like fossil fuels, mm-hmm. according to this person, because of how many acres of corn you'll have to grow. I mean, I learned a lot. It was fascinating. They talked about the evolution of renewable fuels. And if you look at the footprint over time, the experts from the higher education institution, I think it was Berkeley that presented, and I said, well, that was great. So you're telling us to go to electrification. Can you now give me the evolution of electrification?
Yeah, where is
from the grid? Lithium mining to renewables to what do you do with the waste? Crickets. Mm-hmm. So are we going to just do another thing where electrification is the answer? And then 10 years from now, I have to listen to an expert come in and say it's just as bad as renewable fuels. Mm-hmm. You get my point.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago where we got a rebate to convert to gas. Mm-hmm. And so we just have this tendency.
And now we want to ban the gas stoves. And
yeah, just actually turn on your fan while you're using your gas stove and you're good. I had somebody from the expert side tell me that
because
I go, hey, look, I'm like a lot of people. I like to cook and I'm like a lot of people that and they're like, okay, a lot of people are like you. So just turn on your fan.
Are we paying these people to weigh in on these things?
I don't think.
How did they get them to do that?
I think the ones that I'm thinking of, certain counselors
will ask them.
Yeah. That's my guess.
And they're increasingly, they'll bring in the experts from outside, but we won't even listen to what we're doing internally first.
Right.
Because they have a solution looking for a problem and they want to pass the legislation because they want to say they did something in their first 3 months in office. So I guess we're not policy poor. We have a lot of policy. We just have to implement it properly. That's our problem. We don't implement policy. Mm-hmm. And like on the code side, we have code clutter. So when someone's trying to do a development here, we keep passing new regulations
that
cancel out the other. And one engineer in one bureau will see it one way. Another engineer in another will see it another way. So this goes on for like a year. And meanwhile, time is money. And that's the story of why people complain about our permitting bureau. It's those kind of stories that you hear over and over again. What if we focused on cleaning up the code clutter? That would bring more efficiency, better customer service to those that we're trying to work with and invest in Portland.
Yeah. Well, I know we've talked to architects and stuff who do commercial building and all that, and they definitely say that at least for that type of investment in Portland, it's a complex web of navigating a lot of different
code
and that stuff you're talking about.
But it's the good news, it's on the right track finally. We actually have an integrated bureau where people are just having the hardest time accepting this change. So the last thing we need is a new city council to come in and reinvent the wheel for something that took 5 years to even get to this place.
Yeah.
My point is stay focused on where we're starting to get some incremental gains. Right. And leave that alone. In fact, try to actually be humble and understand it before you think you have a new solution and looking for the problem within that you probably don't even understand yet.
Because there are cool things within reach. I know, I always bring up the James Beard Market.
Yeah.
It's supposed to open this year. And it's, you know, there's examples of stuff like that. That's like you're saying, if we keep on that path, you know, there could
Major
be a
League
bright
Baseball.
Future.
Major League Baseball.
Now we have to always keep building and dreaming. And Portland is a beautiful place to hang out in, especially in the summer. Mm-hmm. So that's really one reason why MLB makes sense for Portland, because we actually have fewer rained out nights than most cities.
I want to bring people here in the summer when it's the best so we can reel them in to start businesses and
you'll sip a beer out there with your friends. And and watch the game.
Well, I'll talk through it. Yeah. I'll probably talk through the whole thing.
The uniforms
are, I have a good time.
The uniforms are cute.
I like the jumbotrons and I like the music.
No, but I'm just saying in general.
Well, they will be.
It's a gay girl moment here, but it's like
they will be.
Baseball uniforms are pretty fun, don't you think? Yeah, come on. Come on. You'll have fun at the ballpark.
And Nike can.
No, I think some of the big things are I've been working with a group of partners that's trying to get infrastructure investments for the waterfront.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
And here's why, because we're at risk of losing some of our traditional festivals because Portland charges them so much.
On Tomacall Park.
Bringing Tomacall Park. Thank you. They have to build all their temporary infrastructure each time.
Right.
And most cities that have a setting like that have some of the pipes built in for electrical and such so sure. that you can plug and play. And we make them bring in everything, which costs a lot of money. So it's awesome to see Rose Festival, Blues Festival, Pride Festival, you name a festival, and the River Hugger people with what's that group? Levinson, Willie Levinson's group. Like they're all on the same page supporting this. So That's we're hoping great. It got through the committee, and hopefully it'll keep moving through to Ways and Means.
Well, that's good news.
So that's like, and it's a big ROI. That would be a big return on investment, and it will force parks to really be in partnership with these folks as opposed to controlling it all ourselves. So I always try to find those ways to move the enterprise on its edges to be a little bit more entrepreneur-like in working with our partners. I think that we're not going to come back. We never have. 70s, 80s was when last time we were really in a really tough economic place.
Yeah.
It was the public-private partnerships that moved us forward. Mm-hmm. So one thing that gives me indigestion is when some from the far left lobby act like anything that has to do with a private-public partnership is bad.
Right.
And I'm like, where are you going to get the money to do this then? So you don't want these festivals? Like, you know, so we have to keep looking for those who are willing to play with us and invest with us and move with us. The James Beard Market is such a good story because I like that Jessica Elkin and her team is looking at it statewide. Mm-hmm. We're a food capital. We grow a lot of good food here. The soil's rich. That's why, you know, my great-great-grandma came here. And so it's like, that's the Oregon vibe, and let the Economic Center have this beautiful, wonderful setting where people can be in that world of the foodie industry. And so, of course, we need that. And that's making progress. Darcel Plaza might sound small, but taking Paranoid Park that no one went to except to do bad things for decades is finally being renovated, and it will be named after Darcel, and it'll be a place to have a joyful activation of events. And we're really looking forward to that opening this summer. And I know they're already in that neighborhood. They're celebrating that they finally have a sidewalk there. Mm-hmm. They haven't had a sidewalk in over a decade.
Wow.
Right? And so it's Talk little things like that that just keeps activating our city. And all the ones that have been successful, we had Clean and Safe work with parks at Director's Park. When that partnership came together, and I did lead that effort over 2 years ago.
Thank you.
The results at Director's Park are phenomenal. And all the people surrounding that used to complain, they're like, bring on these events. Now we have more people shopping. You talk to the head of Nordstrom's, every time we have a big event downtown, that's when she sells things at their store. Mm. And people, we've got to keep Nordstrom's downtown. This isn't a threat. This is a promise that if we continue to not focus on these basics, we're going to lose some of our bread and butter retail outlets downtown. And we don't want that.
Well, yeah. I mean, how does Portland make sense without an REI? Like, it's happening, and it's happening. It happened. It's gone. We don't have it. We don't have a flipping gap.
Yeah.
It's sort of bizarre when we don't have.
No, I had a friend that wanted to go Christmas shopping in Portland, and she said they had to leave because there wasn't enough that was open. So the only thing that's been bringing them downtown are arts events. So that's why I'm a big advocate for the arts economy is because it stimulates the economy. Mm-hmm. Unlike any
People
other.
Shop, they go out to eat.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I think the Nordstrom thing is great because that's something we've been talking about recent episodes of, like, there's so much anti-business kind of rhetoric that I hear out of city council sometimes that it's like, do we really want to be a city that doesn't have a Nordstrom or Home Depot or any of these, like,
the
you
whole
know,
reason
they are big businesses, but like, I don't want to live in a city that doesn't have like anchor stores like that, you know?
Right.
Are you really a city at that point if you don't? I don't know.
I'm with you. Yeah.
And the small businesses help them out and they help each other, and you know.
Now, when you go to Chicago, It's because on the Miracle Mile, you get to see all the major retailers from the international world there. And it makes you feel like you're in a big city. And it makes you, I mean, I end up spending more money just because I'm in that vortex of prosperity and generosity that's flowing. Yeah. And it makes me feel so good. And of course, you're going to buy a little something. And we used to have that not that long ago.
Yeah.
And we have to attract that again. Downtown Portland was not a destination in the 70s.
Right.
And it started to become that way in the 80s. We worked our tail off in the 70s and the 80s to give us the golden years of the 90s and the aughts. This is our 70s meets 80s decade where we have to get humble and hungry, and we have to focus on these basics, bring back currency to our city, bring back positive experiences when you're downtown and all the surrounding neighborhoods, and Portland will start being prosperous again, and then we'll have a much better budget situation each year. Until we start seeing business license taxes go up, meaning the number of them and the number of property tax revenues going up, until that happens, we're going to see declining revenue, and we cannot target tax our way out of this.
Yeah, you jogged my memory a little bit. I was thinking earlier, this is hard because we're on audio only, but I saw you should have to remind me of the business, but I saw a thing on your Instagram where you had a guy with chocolate hair. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
I just thought that was really cool. I don't know. It's a kind of a shout out to,
it's a chocolate, shop on Northeast Broadway. And yeah. he, it's going to come to me as I'm talking the name of it.
Was it Creo?
I'd say it was like
Woodblock chocolate.
Yeah.
Well, all I know is he had this amazing, it's Woodblock. Yeah.
Yeah. They're
it
great.
Is Woodblock. Thank you. And so
I'll link to your Instagram.
Yeah. He made an amazing wig, and the owner put it on, and that was great.
I just thought that was funny. Yeah.
I'm so glad we posted that
in the business.
And that's what I think it's going to take, you guys, is block by block, block by block, get to know those storefronts, get to know those leases that are in those neighborhoods too. We might have four people working at a firm that does, I don't know, information technology contract work around the globe. Like, just keep getting to know those people that continue to invest in Portland. And like anything in sales, you can't lose your current accounts. You've got to sustain your current accounts, right, and then you hope to bring in some new ones.
Retention.
And as a business, we've been losing our current accounts, and we're not attracting enough new ones. So we can do this. Let's stay focused as a team. I hope the city council can come together as a team and focus on the fact that we all want better livability for all Portlanders. We want children to feel safe going to the park this summer. We want the elders to feel comfortable riding the MAX train again, because that's why they are able to age in place in Portland. And
those and living are the people downtown.
And we want people to see downtown as a place that they would want to live in. Mm-hmm. And we know that it also does help when you work in person with those that as a part of your team. So we're seeing an increase in people desiring to do that, and we need to let them. So I'm hoping all the private businesses downtown continue to ask their employees to come back to work, because it just makes Portland a better city. And I really feel like our best days are still going to arrive, because you're going to keep electing rational people that are going to focus on their jobs, and Portland will turn around.
Thank you, Dan. Now, can anybody contact you from any district? It doesn't have to be District 2.
No, of course, I'm partial to District 2 because it's North and Northeast Portland where I represent. But the good news is we're all connected. It's one city.
I hear from a lot of people that are like, boy, I really like Dan Ryan, or I really like Eric Zimmerman, but they're not in my district. And if I email them, I don't want to, you know, clog up their email or harass them. They probably won't get back to me, but it's okay, right?
Well, go ahead and reach out to council.
And not just you.
No, counselor.ryan@portlandoregon.gov. And what we can also help with is connecting the dots to what they're seeking. So there was a couple times last week where I helped the person reaching out, not from my district, get to know the people in their district and get to know the person in the city's enterprise, a part of the administration that they could meet. So our job is many times as a constituent person is to do the proper matchmaking to help them move the work and get the results that they intended.
Yeah, and it's
you just
important.
Have to be the office of yes, not the office of no.
It's important, even if they want to address you, it's important to CC lots of other people, right? So that other counselors understand that, hey, Dan Ryan's ideas might be the ideas of your constituents.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate you having me on here today.
Thank you for coming. Thank you, Andy, for co-hosting.
Thank you both. And Krista, thank you for having a program like this. Keep the dialogue going. And your listeners, we really do want to hear from you. We want you to show up and testify. Mm-hmm. Again, you can do it on Zoom. You can come with a group of friends to the council chambers, to Multnomah County chambers. But we need your voice right now, now more than ever. And we'll turn this city around.
In person is preferable, but you can, you know, I've been at city council meetings where people Zoom in and it's not ineffective, I'll tell you that. It's important that they hear from other people who share from you. It's important that they hear people who have concerns and that they hear that there are Portlanders who care about things like public safety or small businesses or any of the myriad topics that we talked about today. If you care at all about those things, please sign up to testify and let city council know that that's on your agenda.
Sounds good. And let's all keep our fingers crossed that we'll see a budget from the mayor on May 5th that we all can get behind.
Thanks, Dan Ryan, District 2, Portland City Council. Thank you.
Thank you.